The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, British cinema went back to the future as the British Film Institute once again took over funding duties of British film from the UK Film Council this time. What does this Tory-inspired shift mean for the future of British cinema? A panel of independent film experts discuss. With government handouts in mind, we meet Gareth Edwards, perhaps the future of British independent cinema, a self-starter and very talented director, digital animator, writer and cinematographer. His film Monsters is released in the UK this week, and he's here in the Film Weekly studio to discuss a new kind of indie cinema. Sam Brooks will be along to review some of the week's other releases, including Will Ferrell and Tina Fey, who voice Megamind, Julian Schnabel's latest canvas, the film Miral, and French Oscar contender of Gods and Men. It's a monstrously good edition of your favourite film podcast. It's Film Weekly. You may remember the name of director Gareth Edwards from our podcast back in June ahead of the Edinburgh Film Festival, where his new film Monsters was screening. Before I'd even seen the film, I was struck by this man's guile, guts and creative nous. Well, this week sees the national release of that film. Monsters is an indie sci-fi road movie romance shot on a micro budget. The story starts 6 years after a NASA probe with evidence and samples of alien life crashes on re-entry to the Earth, leaving a huge part of Mexico an infected zone. Andrew, played by Scoop McNairy, is a streetwise war photographer covering the area. He's agreed to escort the vulnerable daughter of his newspaper's owner, Samantha, played by Whitney Able, out of Mexico, across the zone, and back to safety in America. So begins their adventure in a land filled with monsters.
Viene para nosotros, sobre nosotros. Apúrate.
Apúrate, apúrate.
Sí, viene cerca, es grande.
Por favor, Juan. Calder, come on. Stop taking pictures.
Apúrate.
What do you want me to do?
Are you looking at what?
Yeah, I'm looking at it.
Está saliendo más. Viene más para nosotros.
Hay una cosa en la...
What is that? What is it?
The story of how the film was made is practically as exciting as the film itself, so I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by its creator. A big welcome to you, Gareth Edwards, and congratulations.
Thank you.
I say creator because you are, you know, director, producer, cinematographer, visual effects supervisor, tease body.
There was a tea making, we had one of those tea making machines, so I can't claim that, but I made some coffee occasionally.
Yeah. I mean, because the atmosphere of the film, I like the film, but I'm not a big sci-fi film fan. So what I actually like about your film, Monsters, is the kind of milieu, the kind of the human aspect of it, the kind of devastation that's been wreaked by both the kind of the bifactor, I suppose, of the monster invasion and the political fallout from it. And I suppose that seems to be important to you on a low budget. That's what you can concentrate on.
Yeah, I mean, it's half like, obviously we had a low budget, so we couldn't have a massive like Michael Bay set piece every 2 seconds. But also I didn't want to do that, in that my background's visual effects, and my biggest criticism when I come out of those sort of movies is, yeah, it was an amazing spectacle, but I didn't care about the characters. Yeah. And the story was really over the top. And so for us, it was like, well, I wanted to do, if anything we were going to do was to readdress that balance and really invest in the characters and the story, and then just put the backdrop of this insane situation behind them. And the more we threw it away in the background, I think the more believable the world became, sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of loved the look of it, that kind of almost bombed out kind of devastation of a beautiful land. Obviously, you've got the lush countryside, which I think is real. And then you've got the skyscrapers, which are burnt out, and the helicopters and the kind of army planes swooping ahead. Were they real?
Everything military in the film was CGI, but there was some, it was mix and match when it came to the destroyed buildings and stuff. Without ruining it, we did go to a hurricane hit area. We were on kind of hurricane watch that summer that I was writing the film, and there was this one particular spot that looked completely post-apocalyptic because it had been destroyed by Hurricane Ike. And so we went there, the idea being I wouldn't have to do any CGI. It looked fantastic, you know, as it was. But then I realized pretty soon that there were freeways in the background and there were people picking up, you know, their debris of their house and things
their
like
lives.
This. Lives. Exactly. And so I had to paint them out. So there was a lot of, in the end, CGI in that those sequences.
It's fascinating. I mean, in a way, if you were Hollywood, you would build that set and you would say, let's build some mayhem. But you're actually sort of looking for real mayhem to kind of, in the service of your film. Was there any kind of moral kind of compunction? Like, oh, I'm going into a war zone or a hurricane zone where there is real devastation and kind of tragedy and kind of, you know, not being a documentarist, you're not chronicling that. You're using it in the service of a story.
We spoke to the film council and we were like, okay, so is this ethically wrong? You've got to tell us, you know, should we come? And they were like, no, everyone's left, you know, you should come back in, and we
the
want
film council
to...
in Guatemala or
no, this was in Texas, in, this right. particular place was in Galveston, and they were like, no, come and spend your money, you know, we want people to come back to the area. And we also learned there was a strange legal loophole, which is if you're filming anywhere, you've got to have this plausible deniability that you tried to get permission, and there's two ways of doing it. You phone them or you knock on the door. And you couldn't phone them because there was no electricity because it had all been wiped out, and their door was normally 2 miles down the road. And so it was like, so technically we're okay.
I've actually been to Galveston pre-hurricane. Right. I don't know how you could tell whether it had been hit by a hurricane or not, to be honest with you. It's one of the kind of most devastating places in the world. There's a lovely pop song to it as well. I think there's two pop songs, one called Galveston and another one Galveston Bay. And I always thought, hey, why have they made odes to this kind of quite blasted place on the Gulf of Mexico? But it served your film very well. Because we have got a mix of, the South American stuff, the Latin American stuff, I should say, which is great. And you've got, you know, cast of thousands of extras who are just real people.
Yeah, well, I mean, the goal, I'd never say that we achieved this, but the sort of stupidly high goal we set ourselves was the world's most realistic monster movie. And so we tried not to have any, I mean, in the very beginning, I wanted to have it as like a documentary with no actors and really go there and really try and, you know, create this world and put it all later in the computer. And then I realized that the story I was creating was so crazy that I had to have two actors to sort of, because you're asking a lot when you get, you know, locals that have never acted in their lives to kind of look at the skies if they're seeing something that's not there. So we had these two actors, Scoot and Whitney, who were amazing. But everybody else in the film were people we did the actual road trip. It's kind of a road movie. And we did the actual trip the characters do. And they're all non-actors. They're all people we talked into being into it. And because the film's set years after most monster movies normally end, when life just goes on, the fact that all the people in the background are ignoring it just adds to that realism.
They're living with this, which I suppose they do in blighted political areas. In Haiti, they live with the devastation of a post-earthquake. In South America, they live with the devastation of, I don't know, political corruption or whatever. And I'm sure there's an allegorical aspect to your film. Or are you such a visual effects kind of super thing? You think, no, there's really monsters out.
No, I mean, it's funny because the metaphor I was looking for was you know, science fiction is always usually about something else. And in the past, like, monster movies were really about the fear of nuclear radiation and bombs and then communism. And the modern fear is obviously terrorism. So it was like, okay, how would that fit in this film? Okay, what if, okay, there are monsters in the world, they're bad, they kill people, but at what price is it worth getting rid of them? If you kill more innocent people than they could ever kill, is it still worth doing? So we put that in the film in the background, like there are protests in our film about the military action on the creatures and stuff. But because literally we had a wall in the film that kind of kept them, these creatures, in the infected zone, and it was Mexico, and they're called aliens. They became this big thing about what statement are you trying to make about illegal immigration in between Mexico and America? Yeah. And it was like, none at all. Like,
where are you from? You're from Pimlico.
I'm from Warwickshire. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. A lot of Mexicans there.
I'd never been to Mexico in my life before we started filming.
But... yeah, I think that's the great canvas of that's the being a filmmaker, isn't it, Gareth? That's like what you do.
Yeah, you get to look way cleverer than you really
are. Yeah, exactly. Say, oh, maybe it's a mystery, impenetrable. You mentioned Scoot and Whitney. That's Scoot McNairy and Whitney Able, your two stars, who have since got married.
Yes.
They were at the Edinburgh Film Festival. I had dinner with them there. They were on honeymoon, in fact, visiting the Edinburgh to promote your film. And they got married. Were they together when you were filming?
They had been going out for about 4 months before we started filming. And they basically had a make or break situation. They said, if we get through this film together, then we'll get married. If we don't, we'll split up.
Yeah, a lot of couples have like make or break weekends away in Paris or something. No, they went to make a bloody movie with you.
Actors, that's what they do.
Bloody actors. That's what I wonder, you concentrate on visual effects, you have to work with actors at all. But I thought they were a very good, a very believable couple in this.
Yeah.
Tell us about your trip with them, because I mean, essentially they had the make or break kind of honeymoon, but you were with them, and you and how many others?
There was a very small crew. It was very guerrilla. We were all in the back of a van. There was me filming it, the sound man, a producer and a Spanish translator. And that was essentially the core crew. And then we obviously had Scoot and Whitney, the actors. And I got to be honest, I felt like a bit of a gooseberry a lot of the time because there's this great chemistry that's going on between them as they're slowly falling in love and things that are happening. But and I'm in the middle of it filming. And normally, like, you know, because it's such a small group of people, there's two of them and one of me. So I'm kind of outvoted on most. But I kind of feel like the director's vote counts for like three votes. Well, that's what I tell them.
Yeah, absolutely. And but your film is out here in the UK this weekend, which is great. It's already been out in America.
Yeah.
How was the response in America to this? Not just also from the plot side, but from the business kind of, you know, this lo-fi kind of revolution. I mean, how do they receive that?
Well, yeah, I've been very lucky, basically. When you make a film, especially the way we made this, you blip on the radar of Hollywood and you get invited over and you go and meet lots of people. And so all that kind of happened. And
I think it's because they think you're dangerous. Do you know what I mean? They're like, this guy's too good. We must subsume him into the system.
I'd love to think that's true. I think it's more a case of like, is he an idiot or not? And, oh, okay, he's fine, he's an idiot. And so, but you go and meet all these people and yeah, it's in terms of the industry, it's gone, you know, it's had a great reaction. I couldn't ask for more, really.
It won't go unnoticed also that this week, you know, your film is truly independent in the way you did it, Vertigo backed you. But, you know, the end of the Film Council is upon us, the BFI taking over. Are you a model for kind of future British independent filmmaking? Surely not everyone can do what you did.
God, I don't know. I mean, I would say that this is a good model for a first film. Like, you know, I'd recommend anybody try and pick up a camera and go do something. I just don't think you can do this for your third and your fourth and your fifth film, because with such a low budget level, you know, you do kind of go all the way into your overdraft to get through 2 years of this, and then promoting it for nearly a year, it takes a hit financially.
But how did you even start? I mean, yes, it's a great
Vertigo
idea.
Vertigo funded the whole thing.
So you went to Vertigo and said, can I?
Yeah, we didn't even have a story. I mean, I basically had this concept of, I want to do a monster movie that's set years down the line. And here's my previous work. I want to ad-lib it. I want it to be highly realistic. And I'll stick all the effects in for next to nothing in the background. And they were like, yeah, let's do it. And
then, yeah, but I mean, most people would say, yeah, go away. Don't be annoying. Don't take up my interview, my meeting times.
I spent 10 years in those meetings. And I found someone stupid enough to green light it in the end after pursuing it long enough.
And did you show that you had some stuff to show them? Say, look, I can do these effects. Here's kind of some burnt out.
Yeah, I had some of my TV work. I've done a lot of visual effects for TV.
Such programs as
BBC shows. Like, I did a thing about Attila the Hun and a lot of what you call disaster porn for people like Discovery, mm-hmm. where it's like, oh my God, Dallas is going to be destroyed by a tornado. Let's hope we get some non-actors to look like they can act for next to nothing.
Right, so yeah, you've got form in the kind of, you know, disaster zone. Watch out, with Gareth Edwards is coming, your place is going to look blasted.
I have a fetish for post-apocalyptic situations, for sure. Doesn't everybody, though?
Like, I think, yes, they do, but I think this is a very apt moment in which to get you out of the building very quickly. Gareth Edwards, it's a terrific film.
Thank you.
As I say, I love the human element of it. We could get into the whole monsters, because you don't hardly see them at all, and how you design monsters and all that. But I think that's, you know, let people see that surprise for themselves when they go and see the movie Monsters. It's out this Friday across the UK. You will be at the Biffers on Sunday night. We wish you the best of luck. Go on, beat the King's speech. That's
I'll be getting now. Very drunk, whatever happens.
Excellent. Well, I shall raise a glass with you. Gareth Edwards, thanks very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Talking of monsters, Guardian critic Zan Brooks joins me to review some of the week's other releases. Welcome back, Zan.
Thank you.
Did you have a nice week off?
It was very nice.
In the
I'm less,
zone.
Less monsterish this week than
Good.
I was previously.
Well, bare your teeth, because we're going to be talking about Julien Schnabel's latest film, Miral. We'll talk about Xavier Beauvoir's film of Gods and Men. And we'll also talk about Megamind, which stars Will Ferrell and Tina Fey as voices. You can also tell me a bit about Secretariat as well, because I'm rather intrigued about missing that film. So you can tell me about that. But let's start with Julien Schnabel, the artist turned filmmaker. The New York Jewish parents have produced a son who's now made a film about a Palestinian woman's struggle. The young Miral, played by Slumdog Millionaire star Frida Pinto.
Hello. We are here for Miral Shaheen. Miral Shaheen, does she live here?
She is my daughter. There must be some.
Call her, please.
She's asleep. It's very late.
Sit down.
And I'm Miral Shaheen.
See, she's all ready.
Don't worry, Baba. I'll be back soon.
Miral!
There is some misunderstanding. Please, cannot take her. She is a school child.
There she is, Frida Pinto. I kept thinking, God, you're beautiful, as I was watching this film, which I don't think is the right thing to be thinking.
No, you're supposed to see her as an emblem of hope, I think. Yeah. But, then, you know, hope can be beautiful too.
It can be. She is beautiful.
She is beautiful. Beautiful on the outside. Don't know about much more about her than that.
She doesn't give a lot in this film.
She doesn't give a lot out, does she? She didn't really in Slumdog either. And I guess there she's the sort of the shining city on the hill in that film as well. As she is here. Eccentric casting, obviously, because she's an Indian actress playing a Palestinian orphan.
He's got it in the neck, if anyone can actually find Schnabel's neck. Mm. He's got it in it for casting, you know, an Indian woman in this, because she's a star. He actually says, but she looks exactly like Rula Jebriel, who on you know whose book yes. this film is based on, and who is also Schnabel's current squeeze. He got divorced to be with her.
Yeah, yeah. So why not get Rula in?
Well, I don't know if she can act. Oh, you see, I see your dig there. Very good, very arch. But I mean, she starts as the young girl who's taken into this orphanage, which yes. is run by Hayam Abbas's. Hint Hosseini is the name of the woman. So we're dealing with a true story here.
We're dealing with a true story. It's a sort of semi-autobiographical novel, I guess, and it's basically the Palestinian struggle through the generations. It starts with the creation of the State of Israel in 1948 and goes up to the sort of mid-90s and the failed Oslo Peace Accord. So basically, the whole struggle is here, viewed through women.
Yes, it's a sort of generations of women. When I said that on the outside, it's sort of, but there are two women in it who are sort of barely in it, really. They're just a bit in it. This is Mirelle's mum and how Mirelle comes to be at the orphanage. It really is about this woman who teaches this. It's a Palestinian orphanage for Arab children. It's in East Jerusalem, and it seems to preach a path of peace
and understanding and education.
And then she gets sent out 40 years later to go to work in refugee camps and thinks, oh, my people are being bullied by the army.
Yeah, and then I guess she then has to apply what she's learned from Hind to the wider struggle. And she sort of takes up with an activist and you know, is torn between the desire to fight and to preach peace, I guess.
It's an ambitious topic, really.
It's a very ambitious topic.
To get all of this in.
And that's fine. You know, Schnabel maybe is a bit of a bull in a china shop. You know, I'm not sure that he's maybe totally up to speed on all the issues, but then who the hell is?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this isn't one of those issues that the more you know about it, the less you know about it, and that can inhibit you, you know. So you might then think, I can't even begin to tackle
yeah.
the subject.
So at least
why shouldn't he have a go?
At least he's gone in trying to tell it through the story of this this girl, I suppose.
Having said that,
does it work?
No.
Why not?
It doesn't. It's it's not telling us anything that we don't already know, isn't it? It's basically saying, why can't these people get along? Let's try and find a peace.
I actually thought in its specificity, telling the story to the girl, it lost all kind. I mean, I just felt it was very generalised and kind of sketched in, and you know, and they sort of, you know, they sort of, the dialogue's very sketchy. She sort of, should there be a peace process? And
then there's a lot of bad
climbs
dialogue
into bed
like that.
With the activist.
Yeah.
And he sort of says, no, not unless both sides can bilaterally disarm. Right, now shag me. It's sort of like,
I don't have conversations like that in my home.
No, a shame. Because I think you've probably reached
We'd have arrived at an accord.
I think certainly by now, yes.
No, I think it's a misfire. I was never as fond of The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Schnabel's last film, as a lot of
me
people
neither.
Were. I prefer things like sort of Basquiat, really.
Yeah, which I think the problem with Schnabel, it might be that he's Schnabel himself. I think there's too much Schnabel.
Yeah, there's
there.
Way too much Schnabel, and he's not shy of showing it off, is he?
Yeah, and that's
this
quite
is very much his statement. You know, he's taken a novel by his current squeeze, but he's basically turned it into a Schnabel film. And the fact is that Schnabel doesn't know the nuances of this world enough to make it live and breathe.
Yeah, look too pretty for me, and I think it's supposed to look like a sort of Arab film in some way, but it just doesn't.
No.
It looks like a Hollywood movie in some kind of way. Shot, though, is by Eric Gauthier, fine cinematographer from France. That is Mirelle by Julien Schnabel. We'll move on to Xavier Beauvoir's Cannes Jury Prize-winning film Of Gods and Men, or in French, Des Hommes et des Dieux. It's the other way around, for some reason. This is a story of Cistercian monks in a Muslim mountainside surrounded by fundamentalists.
Paul, je pense qu'il faut partir, progressivement.
Célestin?
Je suis malade, je veux partir.
Luc?
Partir, c'est mourir. Je reste.
Voici la nuit, l'immense nuit des origines.
can these monks preserve their devout and harmonious existence while assailed on all sides? And that seems to be the nub of it. And should they let fate decide it, or should they let faith decide their fate?
Yes, I think that is it in a nutshell. I mean, it's based on a true story back in 1996 of seven Cistercian monks who were killed by the local kind of Mujahideen. That's very much the sort of the starting point for the end point for this film, but that's not really what it's about. Mm. It's about faith, I guess, and what life you make for yourself while you're here, and how that life can then lead to a kind of martyrdom.
Using the monks to tell this story, we really get into the kind of daily round of their existence within this monastery. It's very peaceful. It is. They sort of keep bees and they sort of grow some crops and they kind of, it's hard work sort of thing.
Yeah.
And done in silence. Is that drama enough?
It kind of is. There's something fascinating about watching people at work, watching people's daily life. I mean, that's not the sort of thing that you'd think would naturally convert to cinema. There's the sort of famous Hitchcock line of movies are life with the boring bits cut out. This has all the boring bits. But it raises them to a level that they do become transcendent. They do become fascinating, watching the minutiae of these people's worlds.
Yeah, there was a couple of documentaries, sort of. There was one about the nuns set in
West London, yeah.
Yes, No Greater Love. And there was another one called Integrate Silence about some monks in the Alps, Trappist monks, I think they were. It sort of has a documentary aspect in that respect. But where does the drama for you work? Does it get any sort of more than just like, oh, monks work hard kind of thing?
Well, the drama is there because you know that these people are living on a knife edge. They're maintaining a toehold in an alien culture. They have a very good relationship with the local villagers.
Yes,
that
Michael
they have
Lonsdale's
like little medical
doctor,
outreach programs. You've got Lambert Wilson as the head monk who kind of is sympathetic to the Quran and is trying to sort of forge an understanding. And yet you know that it's doomed. And that is, I guess, there's this sort of terrible kind of pregnant kind of drama that's just waiting to come out.
So you like?
I do like. I thought that I like the fact that it's non-judgmental. It's not trying to make a big point. And interestingly, I think Catholic groups and Muslim groups in France have both applauded this, which
it was
I guess
huge,
is
huge hit in
and
Paris.
A huge hit.
It's a sort of surprise. 4 weeks at number one in France.
Yeah, which is astonishing for a film of this scale. I mean, it has to be said that France tends to kind of tip the playing field a little bit in favour of homegrown produce. It clears some of the
But where
cinemas.
We would kind of go, well, let's watch The King's Speech, marvellous.
Yeah.
They've got to watch
it
for about 8 months. Got,
yeah, which is interesting. I think it shows that there's an appetite for some sort of serious, rigorous filmmaking here.
Is that what it is?
I think it is. I think it maybe is going a little bit too much for the martyr tale. I think that we are invited a little bit too much to kind of weep for these people and to see them as these noble, holy saints. I felt that is where Beauvoir was kind of twisting our arm a little
bit.
Yeah,
that's where I was like, there's also a memorable scene, probably one of the year's most memorable set piece scenes, this Final Supper, Last Supper-ish type thing set to Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake.
Yeah.
I thought this was a brilliant scene, sort of from another movie, had been dumped in there. I know that seems to be sort of heretic to say so, because everyone thinks it's brilliant.
Well, I think that's where he kind of shows his cards, doesn't it? He basically then really goes for the sort of the tearjerker, and they're weeping, they're drinking their red wine, and Swan Lake is playing, and they're weeping, and they know what is to come.
And there's all close-ups.
It's all close-ups. And it is a bravura piece of filmmaking, and it is amazing, but you're right, it does sort of blow out the levels of this very quiet, stealthy, sedate film.
That's Of Gods and Men by Xavier Beauvoir, currently an Oscar favourite, I think, is being nominated by all the sort of bodies in its France entry to the Oscars, so maybe see more of it there. Zan, let's change pace very quickly to Megamind.
In case you haven't noticed, you've fallen right into my trap.
You can't trap justice. It's an idea. A belief.
Even the most heartfelt belief can be corroded over time.
Justice is a non-corrosive metal.
But metals can be melted by the heat of revenge.
It's revenge, and it's best served cold.
But it can be easily reheated in the microwave of evil.
Well, I think your warranty is about to expire.
Maybe I got an extended warranty.
Warranties are invalid if you don't use the product for its intended purpose.
Oh, girls, you're both pretty.
Which is a cartoon, a 3D cartoon?
It is a 3D cartoon. I mean, if you've seen Monsters vs. Aliens and Despicable Me, and The Incredibles, then possibly there's no real need to see Megamind. It's one of these sort of wacky superhero animated films. You know, from probably people who've grown up reading comic books but then read English at Brown University, so know how to kind of dismantle the archetypes and play with them and juggle them. So the twist here is again that the villain is the hero, and it's Megamind, voiced by Will Ferrell, who basically defeats Brad Pitt's character, who's called Metro Man, and who is the sort of the Superman figure. But then once he's defeated the hero, where does he go? How is he a villain?
Metro Man's a good name.
Metro Man is a good name. Yeah. And Will Ferrell's character's got this kind of odd speech impediment. So it's set in Metro City that he pronounces Metrocity.
Well, that's an odd speech. That's not the same as Colin Farrell's speech impediment. No, not the same as Colin Firth's speech impediment in The King's Speech.
No, it's not. Right. And it's but possibly even funnier.
Yes, I should think so.
If you laugh,
Tina Fey
things.
Isn't that love
Tina Fey?
All forms. How's this form?
This form is she's in the form of a sort of Gene Seberg-ish news reporter with a little crop.
Right.
She's rather good.
So you think there's a new way? There's an Abu Dussoufla reference to her.
No, I don't think there's any room.
Crying out.
That was my reference.
New York Herald Tribune.
It's fun. It's maybe not kind of laugh out loud funny, but it's certainly got a lot of energy. And if you're interested in 3D, it's a particularly good example of 3D animation. So much 3D now just has that sort of terrible converted feel where it looks like it was sort of tacked on.
Yeah, a lot of it has been.
Post-production, yeah. Yes. Whereas this has proper kind of depth of field. I'm sounding like a sort of horrible kind of nerdy computer buff.
Well, here, no, but you have to sit there with glasses
there
on, so you might as well,
so you might as well get the value.
Yeah, get your notes out. Yeah. Finally, you've seen Secretariat.
I have seen Secretariat. Why haven't you?
Because it stars Diane Lane, and I'm a bit of a Diane Lane completist.
Yeah.
Has the horse bolted before the stable door is closed, and to other such horsey metaphors?
I'm sure you'll be able to catch up with Secretariat on various planes and afternoon TV very soon. Secretariat is a horsey drama about a little horse who wins the Triple Crown, which is like three races in the space of 5 weeks back in 1973. It really happened.
In America?
It really happened.
Is it American?
It is an American. Yeah, it's so American.
Is one of them the Kentucky Derby?
One of them, I think, is. Yes,
I can't watch any film where people keep talking about derbies.
Can you not?
No.
Well, then that's probably why
you
avoided
it.
Yeah. It's also got John Malkovich as a horse trainer who wears like sort of acid golf leisure wear. And it's just one of the weirdest piece of casting because John Malkovich is, you know, you put John Malkovich in with a horse, the horse is going to crack up, really. I mean, they're jittery animals at the best of times.
Now, you know, you were absolutely the best trainer that I could have ever.
You're the best owner I ever saw. Now, Turcon, and we say he's the smartest horse they've ever seen, maybe. I've trained horses my whole life. I still don't have the slightest idea what they know and what they don't know. 3 years ago, I would have said that a racehorse didn't care who his owner was, but then he's not a racehorse. He's Secretariat.
The interesting thing about this film, though, is it's kicked up a bit of a stink in the States, where it was accused of being kind of Leni Riefenstahl-esque propaganda.
Well, for what?
Of basically kind of homespun American values. It's set in 1973, but there's virtually no reference to Watergate. Little kind of rumblings of Vietnam way noises off. And it's made by Randall Wallace, who wrote Braveheart,
yeah.
And We Were Warriors, and is obviously a close personal friend of Mel Gibson. And also apparently wrote the hymn that was played at Ronald Reagan's funeral. So, you know, he's a God-fearing American.
I've got to say to you, Secretariat, that is a crap name.
It's awful,
for a film.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Unless he's very famous. Unless he's like Red Rum. Is he the Red Rum of America?
You
know, I might see. But even Alden Eatty, famous, they called him Champions.
Yeah.
You know? Because I know it's Bob Champion. I'd see that. Secretariat. Do you know what? I thought it was about some sort of typing pool.
You thought it was that Maggie Gyllenhaal
yeah,
film, yeah?
Which would have been interesting. John Malkovich would have certainly been making
he
her just.
He probably thought that as well, and that's why he signed up for this. And now look at him. He looks like a joke.
Zan Brooks, for your reviews, thank you very much indeed. If you want to catch more of Zan, go to the world's best film site, guardian.co.uk/film.
We've announced the British Film Institute is going to be the lead body for film policy in this country. It will bring together the work it currently does in terms of heritage and cultural support for British film, and it will now take on the functions of distributing lottery money for film production. So I think that's a very exciting development. It'll be a transformed body. It won't simply be absorbing the functions of the Film Council and carrying on as normal. It will have to change, become more commercial, more outward facing, create more partnerships with other parts of the film industry. So that's the key change. But I also think that the changes since we announced the abolition of the UK Film Council, I think a lot of people have come to the table. You know, it's good that Odeon, for example, is making a real commitment to promote British film in its cinemas. It's good that BBC Worldwide has now come to the table to say, well, how can we support exports for British film? So I think there are now a lot more voices as part of this conversation.
Ed Vasey there, Minister for Communications, Culture and Creative Industries, who announced this week that the role of the BFI will be changing. The major changes in state funding of film here in the UK will be an expanded BFI, who've assumed the duties of the now-defunct UK Film Council. Will this expanded BFI bear fruit, or is this just a cost-cutting exercise with very little for a film industry that's been thrown from pillar to post politically over the last two decades? Joining me to discuss the future for British cinema, I'm joined by Lisa Opie, Chair of East Midlands Media, or EM Media to you and me, the people behind things such as This Is England, Control, and Paddy Considine's new film Tyrannosaur. I'm also joined by Mia Bays, an independent producer and distribution consultant, who's produced films such as Shifty and is working with Plan B on his new film, Ill Manners, and by filmmaker and avid blogger from Shooting People, Ben Blaine. Welcome to Film Weekly, everyone. Thanks very much for joining us as well. Is this an interesting week for British film? Ben, you were across it as the kind of announcements were being made, and judging the reaction from Shooting People, the independent community set up for British filmmakers. What's their reaction been on the interweb?
When it was announced in the summer, I think everyone kind of went, "Well, it'll be the BFI then," and there was a lot of kind of like a divide then of some people who are really jubilant, some people who've sort of always hated the Film Council because.
They probably turned their films down or something
quite
like
probably,
that.
Probably, yeah. And so they kind of went, hooray, at last, it's gone. And then other people went, no, it's terrible. And then, yeah, just to kind of like to find out, well, it's going to be the BFI and there's rumours that it's probably going to be the same Film Council team. I mean, I think it's a good thing. I think it's great that finally there's been an announcement and we know roughly what's happening, or at least we sort of start to know what's happening. And, you know, the BFI is a great organisation with a great history and it's, you know, it's good that it's them and not sort of, you know, it'd be awful if they just started up an entirely new thing. Yeah, I mean, that would have been hopeless.
Yeah, that would have been another sort of waste of money in a way. Lisa Opie from EM Media. Obviously, the waiting has been interminable and kind of awful, especially for a regional screen agency such as yours, which was set up by the Film Council in the first place to kind of promote your area, which is the East Midlands, of course. You know, now you've been subsumed into something called Creative England, which sounds like you should have a tracksuit and a whole kind of team. So what is Creative England? Do you know?
We know a significant amount. We don't know all of the answers at the moment. I think that, you know, the place that the RSAs have been in over the last 6 months to a year has actually consistently been quite secure as a result and as a testament to how successful we have been. We aren't wholly reliant on UK Film Council funding. Our funding comes from a mixed source, so from European regional development funding, etc., etc. And we have been, I think, credited with having been very successful over the years.
I think so. That's why we asked you on.
In a variety of ways, absolutely. So we haven't been sort of sitting there for last year going, oh my God. We have been kind of looking forward to embracing what would come next. What does Creative England mean? Well, I think it's a great idea, actually. I think there has been one or two drawbacks from having a network of regional screen agencies who are all independent businesses in their own right. And one of those drawbacks is that from a regional strategy perspective, we could all have quite different strategies. So I think there's a great opportunity to align what it is that we want to do and what we want to deliver.
I mean, indeed, some of you
have
been much more successful than others. I mean, we've had Screen East, which has gone up the spout over the last few months. We've had some that are, you know, I think EM has been perhaps the most successful of them, which is why I get you on. But have you just been lucky because you had the gifts of Shane Meadows and Mark Herbert's kind of work from Warp going on there and Paddy Considine? Did you just happen to kind of come along at a very gifted time, or presumably you harnessed it best?
No, I think actually that EM, considering its location and, you know, as a part of a region within the UK that is not overserved by the likes of the BBC or any of those big media organisations. It has, you know, lent on us to provide something really quite innovative and to think very creatively about how we service the region.
I mean, you don't even have like the Highlands. Well. Like Scotland's got the Highlands, or you know, East Anglia's got the sea, or like, you ain't got much really, have you, in East Midlands?
But I think that what we have done is taken a very innovative approach to how we have supported creative industries.
So what will a young filmmaker do? Ben and his shooting people kind of posse, there's 60,000 of them, so better be prepared for a stampede. What will they do if they want some financing for a film? They'll come to Creative England, will they, and say, please help me?
I think, you know, the nuts and bolts of how this will be structured is yet to be determined.
Mia Bays, if I may bring you in at this point, independent producer, distribution consultant, kind of general mover along the corridors of power of London film. Let's start, because you've been overseeing the microwave budget scheme, which has seen films like Shifty for this kind of mooted 100 grand being made. That sort of filmmaking presumably is not under threat, really. It's not a great threat to society at large, is it? I mean, doing it cheaply like that is clearly where the way that people need to go.
I mean, in a way, it's kind of ahead of the curve, because it was sort of stopping all the lots of money going into shorts and just, why don't you make a feature instead kind of profile. So that's not really going to change, because we've had quite a lot of success with Shifty, and then we've got lots of good stuff coming through. We've got a great film called Story Fields coming through, and then Ill Man as Plan B. You know, that's kind of rolling over neatly. I mean, what's kind of interesting about the, you know, announcement is kind of what I thought was really interesting is I think what we need to do loads more work on is kind of promotion of films internationally, of British films. And so I was really interested in that whole thing about BBC Worldwide partnerships, about Odeon doing this British film of the month.
Yes.
All of that was the stuff that struck me. I don't, as Ben said, I don't think any of us were surprised by the announcement, and you know, I've been in the film industry for 20 years. It's all cyclical, you know, and as my mother would say, a change is as good as a rest. So, you know, I think sometimes it's good to have a little shake up, but I think what's really interesting is the other stuff that has got less attention.
I've been long championing a British screen at multiplexes, which I'm delighted to see that Odeon is sort of going to do that. They'll sort of play, maybe that British film of the month means it plays for a month, because that's the hardest thing. A film like Shifty, which a brilliant film, which I loved, but it you know, it didn't do well on its first weekend for whatever reason that was, then it disappeared and people couldn't find it till it came out on DVD. If it had played for a month at several multiplexes, people would have started talking about it, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing, to kind of hold on to that, you know, to grow the home market and hold on to those screens. And so if a major chain like Odeon is going to really get behind it, then behind key films, then that's what we need.
So it's subtly, it's sort of a private partnership that it's almost quota. But it's not quite a quota, because that would be sort of anathema to the Tory kind of Tory kind of ethos, wouldn't it, really? And there's a piece on Shooting People's website about the old quota quickies from the 30s and 40s that kept the British industry turning over. It was interesting. I saw it in Ed Vaize's speech. He sort of said, "Well, there are not two film industries here. People say there's Hollywood and the British film industry, and they're both here." He sort of sees them as two sides of the same coin. How do your members, Ben, see themselves employed? Do they find themselves working for Hollywood studio productions?
Some of them do, yeah. You know, there's a lot of people who kind of do work on the Harry Potter films and all of those other films kind of in, you know, in various different roles. But I think there is still a very strong sense that kind of like, there's definitely, if you're working at, it's like on the crew side or, you know, an actor, that's really vital and it's really important. And it's very easy to attack kind of like, you know, Hollywood coming over here and making films here and forget that, well, actually that does just employ all the amazing cast and crew that we have in this country. But at the same time, I think there is sort of a divide between those people and then the writers and directors who generally kind of sit on the outside going, oh, that looks fun.
I want to be part of that.
Yeah.
Mia, a suggestion that the BFI now take control. What sort of films do you think that the BFI will then make? As your mother might remember, that cyclical thing, Change is Good Rest. Back in the 80s, there were the BFI who were in charge of film production here. They made three or four films a year. They were Greenaway, they were Jarman, and sort of that was about it. Are they going to go back to those times?
Well, it just, I mean, a lot depends on who the gatekeepers are going to be, I think, and we don't really know anything about that yet, although there's lots of rumours abounding. So I think that there is definitely, anyway, there has been a move on the part of the UK Film Council to kind of fund artists' films and to kind of get back more into that sort of, you know, BFI style of the 80s, production board, the Greenaways, etc. So I think that's kind of been happening anyway. I presume that they're just that's going to naturally flow into.
Well, in charge of the BFI, of course, is the chairman, who's kind of won out very pleased with himself, he must be too, Greg Dyke. Knowing Greg, you know, he invented Roland Rat. I can't imagine him sort of saying, yeah, we must have loads more artists. This is a man who's kind of opened up the London Film Festival to be a sort of launching pad for kind of Oscar movies as well. I can't see him kind of commissioning just pure art movies. I think there will be a commercial nouse to his movies. Let's just hear a little bit from Greg Dyke and his reaction to the news that he was going to be in charge of British film from now on.
Well, I think it means there's now one leading film organisation in this country, which is going to be the BFI, and I think that's a good idea.
And for the BFI itself, this is a sort of step change in your responsibilities and the scope.
Yes, it'll make us, I mean, hopefully not too much bigger in terms of much more responsibility, but I mean, obviously this is all about saving on overhead, and we think we can do that and save quite a lot of money for out of the lottery fund, so that this money will then go on to film production and other film activities as opposed to being spent on us.
And how much bigger, can you put a figure on how much bigger do you think the BFI might get? How large an organisation is it currently?
So, well, of course, we're, at the same time we're having our own budget cut, like most public bodies in the arts, so we're soon to announce reducing our current overhead anyway, the current number of people we employ. So quite how many will move across from the UK Film Council, that work is still to be done. We will have nothing like the overhead it's had while at the Film Council.
And how do you rate the health of the British film industry today generally?
Well, I think the Minister today got it right when he said the film industry has done OK. It's done OK largely because of lottery funding and a big tax break for people wanting to come make films here. And that's been good, and I think that will continue to expand. But I mean, our job now is to try to work with the industry and work with all the facets of film in this country and say, okay, what is the film strategy for the future?
But Greg Dyke, he's in charge of British film now. I mean, he used to have TV, he was Director General of the BBC. Now he's kind of in charge of films in this country. Good thing or bad thing, Lisa O'PV in media?
I think that the BFI will absolutely grasp the opportunity that it's been given, and I think it's a fantastic opportunity. And I don't think, you know, given their past, given their heritage, that culture and commercial are mutually exclusive. I do think that there is a centre ground that they can grab together. And I do think that having an aligned and focused approach to international opportunities is really important and hopefully gives them an ability across Film London and the BBC and that new relationship that was announced as well of pushing forward our stature internationally, which I think can only be a good thing.
Mia, you often work in tandem with Film London, do a lot of work with them as part of the Microwave scheme. They've now been charged with this kind of an extra bloated kind of, I suppose, remit of trying to attract inward investment. What is inward investment?
Well, it's attracting studios and film from all over the world to come and shoot in the UK.
Which is essentially what they've been doing anyway, just sort of come to London and here's a picture of the Houses of Parliament, here's a red bus, get on with it.
Yeah.
It's been slightly, more than it's that, been slightly basically. More creative than that, hasn't it, to be honest? That's one of the better things I think that's happened, is that we do end up seeing better bits of London, even London Boulevard recently, the William Monaghan film, big Hollywood production here, which is a bit of crap film, to be honest with you. But the locations look good. It was lit by Chris Menges. It was a good-looking London that we've kind of found. Has a new character of British film emerged over the tenure of the Film Council, this 10 years? Are we going to see, can we actually sort of put a sort of marker on British film that we've now got to sort of say, well, come here, make British films. These are the sorts of films. And then, as you were saying, internationally, what does a British film do? What does it look like? What does it feel like?
Well, I think the inward investment is one thing, because that's very much a kind of economic imperative that is, I think London's like the third most busiest film hub in the world. So, of course, that's one thing, because that keeps all our technicians, as Ben referred to, and studios, most importantly, incredibly busy. And then there's a separate task, obviously, that the Film Council and now BFI, and in, particularly in terms of the British film imperative. And I guess it's just making, it needs to have a balance of, you know, it really always comes down to the people who are in charge and who are the head of the funds, and often their sort of taste and finding a balance. It really usually comes down to that. And I just hope that we have as many gatekeepers as possible. I hope it kind of, there is a bit of a fresh blood in there. There is a bit of a range of tastes.
Thank you very much indeed for this panel. I think we, you know, settled it for people who are listening to, they know a little bit more about where it's all going to go, and let's hope it's still hopeful rather than kind of we're all downcast, yeah. Which is kind of amazing after a government minister speaks, and normally they get up in Canada, they will say, oh yes, I thought the full Monty was excellent. And in a way, you know, there's hope here. Which three people saying it's hopeful, I even say it's hopeful, that kind of means that we must be going in the right direction. So Mia Bays, thank you very much for joining us. Look forward to seeing Plan B's work, Ill Manners, in the coming future. Lisa Opie, can't wait to see Paddy Considine's Tyrannosaur, the latest offering from EM Media. Wish you luck now in your Creative England tracksuit on your bench there. And Ben Blaine, thank you all very much indeed.
Thank you.
And a big thanks also to my colleague John Plunkett for his interviews earlier this week with BFI Chair Greg Dyke and Ed Vasey, the Minister for Communications. And that brings this edition of Film Weekly to an end. Thank you to all my many guests this week, to Mia Bays, to Ben Blaine and to Lisa Opie, and of course to Gareth Edwards. The music we've been featuring this week is the brilliant score for Monsters by electronic composer and remixer John Hopkins, who's worked with everyone from Brian Eno to Coldplay. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this week, of course, for my Trailer Trash column, giving you the inside track on the film gossip. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.